Okay, then let's move to the next agenda item, which is post-implementation review of IFRS 9 financial instruments, but not the whole IFRS 9, only concentrate on classification and measurement. And I will hand over to Laura, who will introduce this.
Yes, thank you. Thanks, Martin, and hi, everyone. And thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you about IFRS 9 today. My name is Laura, and I'm on the staff working on the post-implementation review. And then also here today is Rihanna, and Rihanna leads on all our financial instruments-related projects. So before we get into the discussion, I'm just going to give a brief overview. So bear with me a second while I just get the slides up. Okay, flick forward a bit. Okay. So by now, most companies will have published their third set of accounts using IFRS 9, and the board just recently began the post-implementation review. For now, as Martin mentioned in the PIR, we're looking only at one section, so we're looking at classification and measurements. So the requirements for measuring instruments, either at amortized cost or at fair value, and for determining where in the income statement we see fair value information, so in P&L or in OCI. And then later on in the not so distant future, the board will also be looking at the impairment requirements, the ECL, and then just to mention regarding hedge accounting, the board has a separate ongoing project. So we're not looking at that at the moment either in the PIR. So we're at an early stage of the PIR right now, and at this point, what we're really doing is speaking to a wide range of stakeholders to gather your feedback on how well you think the requirements have been working in practice. Have they met the ISB's objectives? What do you think is working well? What do you think might have been challenging? What was as you expected? Maybe what has been a surprise to you? All that kind of feedback. And then once we've gathered all the feedback, the board will use it to decide which specific matters it wants to gather more detailed information on. And it will do that in the second half of this year by publishing a public consultation document, similar to the request for information you would have seen recently for the PIR of IFRS 10, 11 and 12. So for today's meeting, you'll have seen in your agenda pack that we provided you with quite a lot of support material as background. And in that background material, we shared with you some specific questions on some of the different areas. So for example, relating to the business model assessment, there were some there relating to SPPI and to own credit and financial liabilities. And really just to say, the purpose of sharing that information with you and those more specific questions was to provide a reminder of some of the board's objectives when it developed the requirements, the improvements that were made by IFRS 9, and then also some of those hot topics when the standard was issued. And the questions there are really some of the things we think it will be useful to look into when we're reflecting back on those objectives and those topics. Saying that, our session today is 45 minutes. So just to confirm, it does say in the slide deck, we're not planning to go through all of those questions. Instead, what we'd like to do is to focus on these three overarching questions that we've got in slide three. So in terms of how to run a discussion, I'd like to ask members for your views first, perhaps on questions one and two together, because those two questions are fairly interconnected. And then after that discussion, I'll ask you separately for your comments on question three, because that's more of a standalone question. So question one we have here is, are the requirements working intended? So have they resolved the issues they were designed to address? Is the resulting information useful for investors? And how have the requirements been dealing with market changes? So an example of that would be new instruments or new features that appeared in the market. And then linked to that, we have question two, which is, have there been any significant unexpected effects? And those effects could be the negative or positive ones that perhaps hadn't been anticipated when the standard was issued. So I'll hand over to members to discuss questions one and two. And just to say, for the whole discussion, I'll leave this slide on the screen. But if you do want to minimize it, I think all you need to do is click in the top left-hand box where you can see everyone, and then that will that slide will go smaller. Thank you.
Okay, has anybody a comment to this first two questions? Please use the chat room if you want to speak. I think everybody's happy, Laura. It's working well as intended.
That's not bad. We don't mind that.
Okay, Ian. Are you on mute, Ian? Cannot hear you. Still cannot hear you. Okay, you will try to fix it. Anybody else who wants to speak?
This is Sandy Melisic. In general, I can't see the page that she's on, but in general, I know that the standard setters have been moving towards having eliminating industry-specific guidance. And for a lot of the financial instrument type of guidance, it's seems as if it's complicated the accounting for non-financial institutions, and it's been quite costly to go through a lot of the different elements within the standard. So I think for the most part, eliminating industry guidance is appropriate, but I think in some instances, there should be a separate cost-benefit analysis. So I've pulled up the package separately. I can't see the slide because I've had to dial in on my phone. Can you tell me what page you're on?
Yeah, no problems, Sandra. It's slide three, the one with the pie chart in the middle.
Okay.
And then maybe if I could just ask a follow-up question. Are there any particular areas you're thinking of when you're thinking of places that are complicated for non-financial institutions?
Let me give it a little bit of thought. There are a number of different areas that I think had we segregated financial or treated financial institutions separately, that the broader theory and application could have been more cost effective for other companies. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. I have to get my brain thinking.
Okay, man, Stephen had also in the chat room said, okay, I agree with Zandy that for non-financial institutions, I have found this a difficult standard to work with. When is it? mean, what is so specifically difficult? Man, is it more, if we go more to IFRS 7, maybe the disclosure regarding to financial instrument, or is it really the classification and measurement which we try to discuss here? Is it, because man, I think it is not. Okay, thanks. Because I think, man, the standard is more or less, if it comes to classification and measurement, it is a kind of amortized cost that is fair value through OCI, and it is fair value. I think, why is it, do you think it is so difficult? When I have heard quite often that people think, okay, that we maybe have industry-specific guidance for financial instruments, but what I heard is more regarding if it comes to disclosure, because there's a lot of disclosing if you use certain financial instruments, which is in IFRS 9, but it's not so in, if it comes clearly to classification and measurement.
I think, Martin, I think you're right. That's certainly where a lot of costs come into play, are on pulling the details together for disclosures. And I know oftentimes when standard setters can't agree on a specific approach, they will add in incremental disclosures. And I just think that more thought should be given when just a lot of disclosures would be appropriate for a financial institution and maybe a more scaled back for other entities. You still have to go through and prove a lot of information to the auditor. So although in the end, what we disclose may not be material, there's a lot that goes into the process that creates cost and churn in an area that may not be as material.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Sandra. Now, Ian, can you try again, if it works now? Still cannot hear you.
This is Aki. Can I ask a question?
Yes, Aki, please go ahead.
Thank you. My question relates to the financial asset equity investment in page 19. Please take a look. So I understand, you know, entity can have a choice between OCI recognition and PL recognition for market fair market value change. But looks like this is very unflexible. We have to make a choice at initial point, but not, we cannot change later on. That's my understanding. It's not necessarily such a fixed situation in non-financial institutions environment. Sometimes those investment purpose of owning those investment may change from time to time. So I prefer more flexible choice during the course of business. That's my point. Thank you.
Okay. I think it is not a choice. It is okay if you meet certain criteria, you can elect then the
value
was the item. It is not I think without any conditions of choice, but thanks for this comment. Richard, you are next.
I don't have many comments on classification and measurement. Lots of comments on IFRS 7 and hedging, but classification and measurement hasn't been the issue for me with IFRS 9. Again, like Aki, we have some consideration of this classification through OCI and applying that. We have some things we're looking at there, some odd kinds of equity investments that might be appropriate. But other than that, no great issues with classification and measurement.
Okay. Thanks, Richard. Stefan, floor is yours.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit along the same line. I mean, with the classification, we don't have a big issue, but I agree also to the point before, the disclosure part, that's kind of rather, yeah, extensive for a non-financial company, which you need to go through for a rather non-significant part of the P&L in our case. So in our case, the note on financial instruments is basically the second extensive note we have. That's a little bit kind of, I think, beyond the point what it should be. But not to the question which you have raised here. I mean, that has worked pretty okay. There I don't have any issue.
Okay, thank you, Stefan. Now, Ian, third try. Usually you are not so silent, Ian. You still can't hear. Maybe you could use the phone. Before that, let's go to Srinath. You want to comment?
Hi, I have a couple of comments on transition to IFRS 9 in my experience with my company. One area where we had to put in a lot of effort and the benefit associated with what was very minimal, it was more disruption to the process, is the way in which the bad debt provisioning as per expected credit loss method for a non-financial institution. What I have experienced is it is a bit of overkill for a non-financial institution to go through explaining the process in line with IFRS 9 and providing supports to our auditors going through this process involved a lot of time and effort within the finance function. And I believe that is a bit overkill for a corporate like ours.
Okay, but that
so if at all, if anything can be simplified in that area, that would be helpful.
But your point was, if I understood you correctly, on the expected credit loss model, not on measurement and classification. Is that right?
Not on measurement and classification. That's right.
Okay. But for this topic, we will have, I think, a separate post-implementation review. We will concentrate first on classification and measurement, and then in due course, I think we will then start on the expected credit loss model. But thanks for the comment.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Maybe.
Can I try again?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you now.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I won't add to the points and discussion. I just think in terms of general implementation,
no, we can't hear you. We still cannot hear you, Ian. It worked for a moment, but it's gone. Still cannot hear you, Ian. Sorry. We cannot hear you. He's still speaking, but I can really not hear it. Okay, I think we cannot hear Ian. Maybe he has to restart his laptop. Anybody else who want to comment?
Can I perhaps ask a question if
there are
no other comments? I just want to make sure for the members that have commented on the disclosures that are being, that is the most difficult bit and results in, you know, it's a lot of work for non-financial entities. Are there any particular disclosures that are, or areas of the disclosures that you're thinking about? So is it perhaps the ECL disclosures, or is it the more in general, the risk management disclosures in IFRS 7, or is it just, you know, the whole of IFRS 7 that is difficult for you, if anyone wants to think about that.
Could a comment from the bank side? Actually, ECL disclosures are complicated even for the banks, and actually we never ever received any questions from investors or anybody else, analytics, for example, on these disclosures. It's very, very time-consuming and costly. And if you could simplify on that, I think it would be great.
Okay, thanks for your comment. Anybody else?
Yeah. Hi, it's Stephen. Can you hear me by phone?
Yes, can hear you.
Great. So for me on disclosure, it's more around the volume. Each individual disclosure requires some work. So around sensitivity analysis, around fair value analysis, just to draw out two. But both of those do need quite a significant amount of work to get into. On the measurement point, I do have some experience in measuring a financial investment, which the only way we could measure it was to look at potential cash flows from future dividends. And that's actually really challenging, because you don't necessarily have access to the information that would allow you to do that in a really meaningful way. So there's a massive amount of judgment required in that. Now, I'm not sure whether we could do better with that within the framework of the objectives that is set out in the various standards, but that's just an observation for feedback.
Yes, thanks for that. Man, I think it is a kind of sometimes a problem to fair value certain equity instruments, but on the other hand side, there is not any better measure than fair value, because if you have it at cost, I think it is not meaningful and has not any information value.
Yes, understood.
Okay. Yeah. Richard,
yes. Yeah, on IFRS 7, from a manufacturing entity, I mean, you have a large derivative portfolio. All of the derivatives are hedges. There doesn't seem to be a lot of point in discussing the risk of the hedges, which is the financial instrument, when you're ignoring what the hedged item. So if you're hedging 40% of the production of a plant, you focus on the risks of the hedging item, not the real risk is the 60% that's unhedged. So we had a lot of trouble with that initially. What helped us was the statement on materiality, and we basically convinced our auditors that the whole of IFRS 7 was not material for our circumstances for a manufacturing company. So we basically took all that disclosure out as being not material, even though the numbers were large.
Okay. Anybody else? Obviously not the case.
Martin, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you.
Lucky you. sorry, I missed the back end of that. All I was going to mention was that in terms of the recognition and measurement at Roche, I think we found it relatively straightforward to do the sort of what I would call the treasury part of financial instruments. I think there was a little bit of work to do with our colleagues, but it was sort of all doable. I think the thing that took quite a bit of time was, because trade receivables get captured by the definition of financial instrument, that triggers quite a lot of process. And then particularly if that's the only financial instrument you've got, inevitably you're going to have to sort of go through a certain amount of work there. So I think maybe it's just a point to have in mind when you're drafting standards like this, that the definition of financial instruments does capture trade receivables, and it might trigger a whole load of work that you're not necessarily intending that everybody does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ian, this is Sandy. I'm glad that you made that point. I know in the oil and gas industry, on the trade receivable side, it does create a lot of work based on the fact that we could have delivery, but still the price hasn't been determined because it's done over an average of a few days. So it ends up adding a lot of complications when really doesn't change the outcome very much.
Okay. Nora, would you move now to question three?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Okay, so the question we have on question three is, are the requirements capable of being applied consistently? And here what we're really asking is, do you think that the requirements are sufficiently detailed? Are there any particular areas of the application guidance you think perhaps is not detailed enough? And are you aware of any diversity in how some of the requirements are being applied? And if so, what's causing that diversity and what is the outcome of that? So I will hand back over in case there are any comments on question three.
Anybody would like to comment? Ian?
Sorry, I was just replying to Sue.
Okay.
I have one comment. We do find that we end up using the Big Four firms' guidance material related to the own use criteria for derivative, particularly around virtual PPAs and things like that. So that's maybe an area which is subject to a bit of interpretation.
Okay. Anybody else? Seems not to be the case. Okay, if you don't have any further comments, Laura, from your side, any additional questions, comments?
No questions from me, just to say thank you very much. That was helpful. And second half of this year, the request for information will come out. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Laura. And I would recommend now, because I think we still have three people on the phone, maybe we make a 10 minutes break because we are ahead of time and giving these people a chance to fix. And then I would recommend that we are back here at 12. Thanks a lot. See you.